Hi, this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nagel, and we're happy to have Beatmaster Irwin Goldman back with us. He is a professor and interim senior associate dean of the Department of Plant and Agro. I didn't even try to reread this. Agroecosystem Sciences at UW-Madison. His research focuses on vegetable breeding and genetics, especially beets. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we had this teaser question, whether or not, Irwin, vegetable is a noun or a verb. Now, I have never heard of it as a verb until I read your paper. So where did this even come from?
Well, thanks so much for asking, Jill. I really appreciate that. And thanks for having me today. You know, so I think people historically have thought of vegetable as a noun. It's a thing, right?
Yes,
it's But in fact, vegetable is the product of a very sort of long-term public works project by humans to make a plant that we eat in a very immature stage. In fact, vegetables can't really be propagated as they are. So if you let's just take a carrot, for example. You plant a seed, you get a carrot. The carrot itself can be eaten as a vegetable, but you can't get seed from a carrot unless you store it for 12 weeks, vernalize it, plant it in the ground for the second season and get it to flower. So the vegetable is a kind of specialized crop that humans invented to be consumed immature. And in doing so, vegetabling becomes a verb.
I love it. You think it's going to catch on?
I hope it does. I think in many ways it honors our ancestors who came up with this technology that we've been doing for 10,000 years.
Yeah, that's really true. And, you know, I had never thought about it that way. But, you know, because we just go out and buy our seeds usually.
Of course.
There's a few of us really, you know, good gardeners that collect their seeds. But it does have to go past its eating stage in order for us to collect it.
That's exactly right. And, of course, everybody knows that the grains, so let's take corn or barley or oats or rice, these naturally do that.
Mm-hmm.
They go from seed to seed in a natural cycle. And the wild plants that are the forerunners of those crops are naturally going from dry seed to dry seed. Vegetables, on the other hand, are an intervention. And that intervention made more work for humans. It made humans do all sorts of divisions of labor in order to make it work, but it increased our nutritional diversity. And it increased our dietary diversity.
And now if we think about something like a tomato,
yes,
which is really a fruit and
correct,
not a vegetable, so that's a different way of looking at it.
A tomato's a great example. A tomato or a pepper, these things are botanically speaking fruits. And I think your question points out the fact that vegetable is a culinary term. It's not a biological term. So there are many so-called vegetables that are in our diet that are truly fruits or roots or leaves or stems or petioles. The tomato and the pepper are eaten in an immature stage, so we don't wait for them to get really soft and really moldy on the vine. Instead, we eat them when they're very tender. And in that way, we are honoring that vegetable tradition of eating it immature.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And like strawberries and raspberries?
Yeah, in many ways, too, there are fruits that are that would follow this mold, although some of the fruits are grown on perennial plants, and so they would produce these fruits each year. The vegetables, many of them are annuals,
mm-hmm,
and so the seed, the problem of producing seed on something that you consume very immature, becomes complicated. And I think that insight that humans had is really cool, and it requires a lot of thinking.
It does.
Yeah.
What made you think of this? I mean, were you sitting under a tree and getting a apple hitting your head or something?
Well, I've thought about it for many years, but there's
okay,
a particular poem. There's a poem that I always loved, and it's by W.S. Merwin. It's a wonderful poem. It's called The Widow, but there's a stanza in the poem that I always thought about. I had it pasted on my wall, and I'm just going to read the line. It says, "How easily the ripe grain leaves the husk at the simple turning of the planet. There is no season that requires us." And I love that stanza. Basically, what it made me think of was, in nature, the grains, they go to seed and they go to dry seed naturally. And it will happen even if humans weren't around, right? Yes. That simple turning of the planet is enough to do it. And there's no season that requires us. But humans are absolutely essential for vegetables. And in many ways, it maybe because I'm a horticulturist, I thought, hey, this makes me feel, you know,
important,
worthwhile, right?
So right.
The fact that humans figured out something that required their heavy engagement, but they got great benefit from it, is kind of cool. And I wanted to highlight that as a way of saying, maybe it's like a pat on the back to the humans for figuring this out. And
Well, it's nice because a lot of times we get, you know, we blame ourselves for doing this and that to the planet, but we did some nice things too. So
we did some amazing things. And not to take away from some of our great accomplishments, but I think our crops in some ways are some of our greatest public works projects. Mm-hmm. They took hundreds of generations of humans and thousands of years to develop. And the vegetables represent a specialized niche in there. That is, I think, something to be proud of. It always makes me, I sometimes joke about it, but when you drive up to a part of the world where this particular vegetable plant was native, I feel like there should be a huge statue in the town square of a celery or a carrot.
I like that. I think that there's a future for that. So.
I hope so.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for opening our eyes a little bit, and we appreciate it when we're out there weeding this summer. So
that's right. The weeding makes it all worthwhile to know that we created these things.
That's right. And then when we eat them, that helps too.
I agree.
Well, I was very surprised when I picked up the New York Times not too long ago, and there was your beet. Tell us about that.
It's been wonderful to see people embrace it. I think some of the listeners may be familiar with this idea that beets are a polarizing vegetable. I think, to put it mildly, some
yes.
people just dislike the earthiness of the beet. And when I would talk to people around the state of Wisconsin about beets, that's one of the most common comments I would get, is that beets taste like dirt and I really am not interested. We set out to create a beet that did not taste like dirt, and that is extremely mild. When you pull back, and we did this through conventional breeding over many years, it took about 16 years to develop. But when you do that, when you pull back the earthiness, you're left with just the sugar, the sweetness that's naturally in beet. And so you taste something that's kind of mild, sweet, crunchy, and it's the first beet that we know of that you can really eat without cooking at all. You can eat it just raw. And
it's
just
amazing.
Kind of, you know, maybe an analog for listeners would be something like jicama, or a crunchy, semi-sweet root vegetable. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what it looks like. And, you know, that has been really interesting for people. It kind of creates a new market class of the vegetable. In some ways, it did make us feel a little guilty, de-beating the beet, so to speak. You know, like sort of. But in many ways, it relates to the earlier thing we were talking about: is that vegetables are a work in progress. There's something humans developed, and so who knows what the next version of all these things are going to look like.
Right, because, I mean, carrots, weren't they purple to begin with?
Carrots were absolutely purple, and before they were purple, they were yellowish, and before that, they were white. So this is an ongoing project.
Mm-hmm. And I know that people are probably, well, what's the name of the darn beet?
So this one that I think you may have seen is called the Badger Flame
yes.
beet. But we've created a series of beets now that have, another one is called Spark. These are, they're red. They're named for their red and yellow pigmentation in the inside. So if you cut them open, they sort of look a little bit
it's
like they're
beautiful.
Yeah,
beautiful.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. But they're called the culinary part, or the flavor part, is really that the mildness and the low levels of the compound that we call geosmin, which is the earthy flavorant that's present in the beet.
How did you find that earthy flavor? I mean, try to do it for those of us who aren't, you know, horticulturists and scientific and all that
yeah.
good stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, the credit really for this goes in large part to Nick Breitbach. Nick has worked with us for many years, and he's now retired, lives in Middleton. Nick, if you're listening, you know, I appreciate the work you did on this. I think Nick was, his idea and the idea that we had working on this was to do it simply by tasting. So we would taste We would taste hundreds of beets as we were selecting, and we were looking for those that had very, very mild flavor and low astringency, so they were just, you could taste the sweetness. And so initially, we did it simply by tasting.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we began using an instrument in the laboratory called a gas chromatograph that allows you to actually measure that earthy compound. So we could actually quantify it, and we could select based on the actual data.
So you could really fine-tune it then.
You could fine-tune it. And it turns out that geosmin, the earthy flavorant, is, by the way, geosmin is a compound produced by bacteria in the soil. So any gardener who's listening to this show, anybody who's listening to this show knows what that smell is like when you first turn over the soil in your garden. You smell that earthiness. That's geosmin, and it's being produced by microbes in the soil. Why a beet or a Swiss chard plant or a spinach plant produces geosmin is something we still don't understand. There is no good explanation yet for that. We have since been able to sort of custom design or custom breed these plants to have lower levels of some of these compounds so that, you know, maybe one of these days we'll figure out what the thing is doing there in the first place.
Very fun. I love that. Thank you for describing that for
mm-hmm.
us. Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed to ask, are badger red beets available anywhere locally? He would love to taste one.
So the badger beets are available from a couple different seed companies. You can go online and you can find a couple of different companies that are selling the seed. One of them is the High Mowing Seed Company. They're based in Vermont. Another one is the Row 7 Seed Company. And these are companies that have licensed that variety from the University of Wisconsin.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So locally, are we going to be able to find them in our grocery store?
So last season, they were in 300 grocery stores on the coasts.
Okay.
We didn't see them in the Midwest yet. They were in New York State. They were in California. And they were in Boston. We think this year, some of that, this season, this it would probably be this fall,
mm-hmm.
I mean, starting maybe
sure.
in August, we think they will start showing up in Midwestern stores as well.
Okay, maybe farmers markets?
Farmers markets, I would hope so, because any farmer or any gardener could have obtained seed of it and grown it here. So we hope we'll see
okay.
them. Yeah.
All right, excellent.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Erwin Goldman, a professor and interim senior associate dean of the Department of Plant and Agrosystem Sciences at the UW-Madison. What vegetable questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nagel. Next week on Garden Talk, we're going to be talking to Mark Dwyer. He's going to be back to talk about perennials. And then we'll also talk to an author about her book on rhubarb. And we will learn about Japanese gardens. So all kinds of fun next Friday. Right now, we're having fun with Professor Erwin Goldman talking about his lab and his work at W. Madison. And we've got some calls coming in. But before we get there, what besides beets do you work on
carrot and onion as well.
Okay.
And so we sort of specialize in the biennial root crops.
Biennial
That's our
root
thing.
Crops. I like that.
Yeah. And they're a challenge because to breed them, biennial takes two seasons to go from seed to seed. And so to breed them, you have to first grow the crop and
right.
then you have to store the crop, vernalize it, and then plant the crop in order to get it to produce seed. So they have, it's an acquired taste.
Sure. Literally.
Yes.
And how does that work with the students? How do they participate
yeah.
in what you do?
The students are absolutely essential. We could not do this work without them. They spend their time not only during the growing season, but during the winter season when we're growing the seed in the greenhouse, helping with every single aspect of this process. And I mean, any plant breeding program has built into it just an enormous amount of hands-on work. You thresh the seed, you clean the seed, you put it in a packet, you plant it in the ground, you thin the plants, you weed the plot, you measure the plants, you harvest them, you trim them, you store them, you plant them in greenhouse pots. Every single stage requires lots of hands. So we have about 10 people. We meet every single morning at 8 o'clock and start our work. And any given day, we are out around the farms of Wisconsin, or we're in the greenhouses, or we're here on campus doing this work. So
that it's amazing how many spots that this is happening and how many students are involved in this. And can people just like come and visit? Is that
absolutely
possible?
I mean, we would be so happy to have people visit. We're not really set up to be a, you know, to host visitors every day, but if people wanted to see what our nurseries look like and our plots look like, I would be so happy to show them. And I should say too that the University of Wisconsin-Madison, like many land-grant universities, is home to dozens of programs like mine who are breeding cereal grains, who are breeding melons, cucumbers, cranberries, potatoes. And this is one of the ways that we contribute to agriculture in the state of Wisconsin. And it is not only creating new varieties, but it is, as you said, Jill, training the students, educating the students who are going to go on and do this work.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's all part of the Wisconsin idea.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Bo in Madison has a question. Go right ahead, Bo.
Hi. I was just actually listening to the thing you said about the agent that's both in the soil and the beets. I think you call it gensimine. What was the name again?
Yes, you're right. Geosmin is the name.
Geosmin. So I actually have a background in environmental geology, so I've studied evolutionary biology. Is it possible the beets are developing that as an adaptation so animals think it smells like the earth and then is less likely to eat it?
It's a very interesting question that you ask. Beets haven't been around for that long because they too are a creation of humans only within the last probably 3,000 years. So it's a little hard for me to imagine that enough evolution could have gone on in that period of time. But your hypothesis may have some merit to it. One of my favorite ideas for why they have geosmin is something that you'll be very familiar with, horizontal gene transfer from microbes, so that the microbial genome has introduced a number of genes into the plant genome, and for reasons unknown yet, I think maybe they could have introduced the genes for the production of this volatile. But again, I don't know the answer, and your hypothesis is super interesting as well.
Yes, definitely. Let's go to Jim in Ashland next. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. You've got just the expert I need to ask about. I grow my own seed. I've done it for 20, 30 years. Hmm. What's happened is I've got a product that appears to me to be a cross between Swiss chard and beets.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes like jicama, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Can they cross naturally? It seems to breed true. This will be the fourth year that I've planted the seed.
Mm-hmm.
The seed looks like a beet seed.
Absolutely. I have no doubt that you did, in fact, hybridize those. They cross freely. And there are even commercial varieties out there that are crosses between beet and chard. They're sold as they're sold for their foliage, and you can buy them. You can buy them in certain seed companies. So I think what you have is absolutely that hybrid.
Wow, how do you feel, Jim?
Thank you.
That's cool. That's terrific.
That is pretty exciting. Thanks for sharing that with us, Elizabeth in Platteville. You're next. Go right ahead.
I have a PhD in botany, and I also, my husband taught horticulture at Platteville at the university. And because of that, I learned about a lot of vegetables that are available. There are what are called rainbow carrots. They're available in some seed catalogs.
Yes.
So there are purple, yellow, orange, red, and white. And the red carrots are the most tasty of all the carrots because my husband planted them and we ate them. The strawberries, the true feet fruits, are achenes, which look like seeds on the outside of the strawberry. So you eat the what is called the receptacle.
Right.
Okay, well, thanks, Elizabeth. That's really interesting. You know, we take all this stuff for granted, don't we? That's wonderful. Elaine in West Bend emailed to ask if the new badger beets have a similar amount of iron as the red beets do.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't have any reason to suspect it would be different. The only really thing they're different for, besides the color and the shape, is this this earthiness.
The taste, yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nikki in Milwaukee emailed to ask for recommendations for growing beets and other root vegetables in containers.
Yeah, it's tricky to grow in containers. I have found that certain root vegetables do well. Beets actually will do fairly well in a container. Carrots, not so much. Why that is, don't really know. So I think it does depend on what you want to grow. And the larger the volume, the deeper, the better. And also, of course, anytime you're doing container gardening, you have to think about moisture because it is very difficult to keep them wet enough. However, crops like carrot are sensitive to sitting in water. So it's really hard to dial the moisture in properly for a crop like carrot. I would go with something like radishes or beets if you can. I think or parsnips, maybe they will do a little bit better than carrot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you would have to have a lot of volume of soil, right?
Yes,
for that,
you would.
To do that. But do some experimenting, Nikki. That's half of the fun.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as your own garden, Erwin, do you garden at home?
You know, I feel like I get enough of it during the day at work these days.
That.
I mean, maybe someday I'll develop it. But we do have some ornament. My wife and I just recently planted a lot of ornamentals in our yard. So we do that. But not so much the edible plants.
Not so much the edible plants. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the experiments you're doing besides the beets?
So our lab is focused on developing disease-resistant vegetable varieties. That's a big thing for
sure.
Growers. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, anything that we can do to contribute to disease resistance means the farmer or the gardener has to use less chemicals, less pesticides, and that sort of thing. So that's a project that we're working on. Another project that we're doing is we're trying to understand the genetic control of shape of root vegetables. So you may be familiar with this. In the case of the fruits, even in peaches, we have flat peaches. We have flat tomatoes. We have little tiny round tomatoes. We have, you know, the fruits, there's huge variation in the shapes of the fruits.
Sure.
We are currently testing a hypothesis that the genes that cause those fruits to be different shapes are the same genes that also make the roots different shapes. And so there are many different shaped onions and beets and carrots. And so that's a big project in our lab, too, is trying to understand the genetic control of that.
And why would we want a different shape of these?
I think we eat with our eyes and we select vegetables with our eyes. And if you look at listeners who have seen the flat onions or listeners who have seen the little baby carrots that are little round carrots, sometimes I think they're very attractive to the consumer.
Yeah.
So we're interested in understanding that so that we can manipulate that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so then your work benefits, and we were talking earlier about, you know, the whole state, but in particular, the farmers that produce these,
the
right?
farmers that would grow these, the gardeners that would grow them, the mm-hmm. seed companies that would sell the seed. And of course, I think the vegetables are just an important contribution to our dietary diversity, nutritional intake, and all of that. So it's a part of that whole system. And these vegetables would go not just for the fresh market, but also for canning. They would go for, you know, for those who preserve food. So in many ways, hopefully it's it's not a major part of the food system, but hopefully an important one.
And do you look for vegetables that are better at being eaten fresh or being canned or frozen?
Both. I have this badger beet that we talked about is more geared towards a fresh market product, but we also develop them, beets and carrots, that can be canned or that can be processed, because that's a very important industry in the state of Wisconsin and in the Midwest. And it's a very important thing for us as a society to have food preserved like that.
Oh, absolutely.
So we do both.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And do the farmers then give you results of their...
Many times we get pictures from them, we get data from them, and we also get to visit their farms and see what it looks like. Because interestingly, a variety won't look the same in all parts of the state. In the central part of Wisconsin, in the sand, it will look different than it would in the mineral soils of the southeast. And so we do need to travel around and look at that.
Yeah, because that really does make sense. So what you grow down here might not necessarily relate. Okay.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, in the last couple, we don't have much longer to go, but in the last few seconds, what would you tell people about beets that they should remember?
Well, I think that it's Don't be afraid of them, I guess is what I'd want to say. Even if you don't like the earthiness, even if you buy regular red beets that are earthy from the farmer's market or from the grocery store, you can roast them. I can oven roast them with other vegetables, and you'll lose some of that earthy flavor, and they are fantastic. So don't miss the opportunity, I guess is what I'd say.
That's a great way to end it. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Thanks to you for joining us at Garden Talk. This and all of our shows, of course, are a team effort, and they include Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaude, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm the executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Go out and enjoy your garden this weekend.